Islamists have been protesting France's presence in the country. So what the Malians want is not really very clear, except the fact that they want the French gone.
The war has been so ineffectual that Malians openly accuse France of arming the rebels, while the conflict is often dubbed France's Afghanistan. Paris has blamed Russian disinformation for turning Malian public opinion against France, but polls in the capital, Bamako, have shown that 80% of respondents believe that France is only in Mali to defend French interests.
France's failed war in Mali has been even more degrading to its image at home and abroad than their failed involvement in Afghanistan. The war has been routinely cited by terrorists as justification for attacks in France.
France has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960, when many of their former colonies gained nominal independence. Mali remains among the poorest countries in the world, but that's not due to a lack of natural resources.
It's believed that Mali has some very important resources that have yet to be tapped, like neighboring Niger, which is rich in uranium. And once again, let's not forget, France gets nearly 80% of its energy from nuclear power. So uranium is an important asset for the French. But it would be difficult for France to say, yeah, we're going to stay in Mali because there's this potential uranium deposit, plus the gold, plus this, plus that, etc.
Analysts say that it's premature to call it the end of the war, but that France is entering into a new phase of the war. France will retain a 3,000-strong army to roam the Sahel region. Armin Mazahari, Paris.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. A study published in the U.S. Environmental Health Perspectives found that no matter which of the main types of air pollutants Americans look at, people of color are breathing more of it. We now present you an article written by Erin McCormick. The piece is titled, How Much Air Pollution Do Americans Live With? It May Depend on Their Skin Color. Air pollution are American people exposed to in their daily lives? A new study released on Wednesday, 15th of December, confirms the answer may depend on the color of their skin. The study published in the U.S. Environmental Health Perspectives found that no matter which of the main types of air pollutants Americans look at, people of color are breathing more of it in. According to the work by an international team of researchers led by University of Washington, while U.S. officials claim some progress has been made in reducing deadly pollutants in the air in the United States over recent decades, the racial disparities have persisted. The group modeled the concentrations of a host of different air pollutants down to the neighborhood block level, then computed how exposure levels compared for different races. The lead author, Jiawen Liu, University of Washington doctoral student in civil and environmental engineering, said, "For all pollutants, where there were noticeable differences in pollution levels, the most exposed group was a minority group." And she said, "The racial and ethnic disparities existed in all states." The research also showed that race mattered more than income in determining who lives with the most air pollution. The study scientifically confirms what many black and brown communities, which have endured outsized amounts of industrial smoke and freeway pollutants, have been saying for decades. Senior author Julian Marshall, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at University of Washington, says, "If you are living in a community that is experiencing the brunt of bad air, this is not news to you at all. You notice it already." He said, "Communities that have been living with the health risks have been speaking up for a long time, and often their voices are not heard." South Los Angeles resident Aretha Wormsley said she was startled recently when she could actually see the mountains that surround her Southern California community. While they're just a few miles away, they're usually hidden by a thick haze of brownish smog. Wormsley, who has suffered from asthma her whole life, now represents her historically black community as a clean air ambassador, working with the Los Angeles chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility to bring attention to the pollution problems in Los Angeles. She said she has seen some improvements, such as a few large polluting factories in her area being shut down. "But we still need a lot of change," she said. Freeways still frame the neighborhood, and Aretha Wormsley said small businesses that cause pollution, like auto body shops and dry cleaners, are still being allowed to open with little attention to how additional pollution will affect the already burdened air. She said, "They put in businesses wherever they feel like it," adding, "They don't consider human lives." She noted, "It's not healthy for anyone, but we're the last ones to consider when it comes to cleaning up the community." Study followed groundbreaking work released by some of the same researchers recently, which identified the racial disparities in exposure to a single pollutant, fine particulate matter. This new study looked at six different air pollutants, ranging from nitrogen dioxide, a freeway gas that spills out of the tailpipes of trucks and cars, to the highly mixed ozone pollution, which forms as swirls of chemicals are exposed to the sun. The study found the racial disparities were generally larger for urban areas than for rural ones. California and New York had some of the largest racial differences. The study, which concentrated on the changes between 1990 and 2010, found that while officials claimed the United States has continued to make gains in reducing air pollution in the decades since the Clean Air Act was passed in 1970, it hasn't closed the gap between the different races. Meanwhile, concerns about bad air have grown. A host of new studies have shown that air pollution lowers life expectancy and worsens health outcomes, even at low concentrations that were previously believed to be safe. Research has shown that air pollution causes about 100,000 deaths in the United States each year. New studies have tied polluted air to preterm births, miscarriages, dementia, and COVID-19. Marshall said, "There's a glass half empty, half full version of this story," claiming, "The positives are that the air has gotten cleaner over time, and the size of the disparities are also going down. Everybody is experiencing cleaner air. On the flip side, he said, it was notable how, across all states and all types of pollutants the study looked at, it was minorities who bore the biggest air pollution burdens. He said, we still have work to do. We can't just focus on addressing the overall air pollution totals. We have to focus on the disparities.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21st, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Ilam commemoration ceremony.
شهید ما در واقع مصداق و مظهر ان الله اشترى من المؤمنين انفسهم و اموالهم بان لهم الجنه.
Our martyrs are in fact the manifestation of this verse. Indeed, Allah has bought from the faithful their souls and their possessions for paradise to be theirs. The Holy Quran, Surah 9, verse 111. In other words, they have dealt with their lives with God. This is how martyrs are.
Ya un ayah sharife sadaqu ma ahadullah alayh. Fa minhum man qada nahba wa minhum man yantazir.
There is another holy verse which says, Among the faithful are men who fulfill what they have pledged to Allah. Of them are some who have fulfilled their pledge, and of them are some who still wait. The Holy Quran, Surah 33, verse 23. They were true to the pledge they had made with God, the Exalted. A martyr is like this. Martyrdom is an act of making a pledge and dealing with God. That is why you see that the soldiers who are fighting in the way of God are different from other common soldiers in the world. Those of you who have witnessed the sacred defense and those of you who have read books on this topic surely know that the pious soldiers in the sacred defense or the soldiers who have defended in other areas such as defending the holy shrines and the like are purer during fighting and in the field of battle than at other times. They also rely more on God, show more humility, and observe the divine limits more carefully.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
در دنیا معمول است که وقتی یک لشکری پیروز میشد در یک شهری براشون غارت و چپاول و نمیدونم ظلم و این چیزا چیز عادی است. اینجا نه خیر. اینجا رزمنده مجاهد فی سبیل الله در میدان جنگ اگر پیروز هم بشود اخلاصش رعایت حدود الهیش اندکی کم نمیشه، بلکه در حال پیروزی به خاطر شکرانه پیروزی این رعایت ها بیشتر هم میشه.
It is common in the world for a victorious army to loot, plunder, and inflict great cruelty in a city. But this is not the case for our soldiers. Even if those who fight in the way of God win, not only does their piety not decrease and they do not stop observing the divine limits, they are even more careful to observe God's limits because of their gratefulness for their victory. Our soldiers would take some of the enemy captive. This was the same enemy who would torture and harass our captives from the time they took them captive up until the time they entered the camp where they were to be kept. And it is clear what they did to them in those camps. But if our soldiers took those same people captive, they would heal them if they were injured, and they would give them water if they were thirsty. They would treat them as if they were one of themselves. So, these are very important points.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
We did it. Chile's Boric has sealed a leftist revival, as it's been described, with his election win. He's a handful of leftist candidates who have won or are projected to win presidential elections in Latin America. Why is there what appears to be a surge in leftist politicians to have risen in Latin America that has struck such a chord with the citizens of the respective countries? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Chile first, then look at other countries that have had a leftist candidate win appeal the masses instead of a right-leaning one, like in the Honduras, Peru, Brazil, and Colombia. Well, let's find out what happened in Chile. Alejandra Kirk is our correspondent joining us from Santiago. Well, if the videos were a testament to what really happened, with tens of thousands of people out there on the streets receiving warmly their new president-elect, tell us exactly what has gone down and what Chile is experiencing right now.
Well, hello. Yesterday, 1.2 million new voters went to the polls. That was a decisive factor in Gabriel Boric's victory. These new people were actually Chile has been experiencing a low, high rate of abstention since vote became voluntary in 2013. This time, after the defeat in the first round of elections, the political leadership of Boric's campaign decided to apply a method used in the past against a digital dirty war by the far right candidate Casta, which was imposing method of fake news and deviating the debate about personal traits of Gabriel Boric. They went door to door. They raised this slogan, 1 million doors for Boric, and they applied this old tactic, technique of popular activism from the 20th century. Local committees, people going door to door, face to face, talking to people, especially the young people, and this yielded this result. 1.2 million people. Boric is not only the youngest ever president of Chile, he's also the most voted ever. And this record is difficult to assess if not for a new way of doing politics. This is a generation change too. This is a break off with the Pinochet legacy. That's how I interpret this. This vote was a plebiscite on whether to continue, not only with the neoliberal policies imposed by the dictatorship and refined after the end of the Pinochet regime, but also with that culture that has been prevailing over the country and which began to be broken by the popular revolt of 2019. There is a constitutional convention working on a new constitution, and Boric has promised to support this work. This constitution should be ready by July, and subject to a plebiscite, approve or reject later on. On the political side, this is also a change of style. A young generation, most of them were student leaders of the 2011 student revolt, and they are bringing some fresh air into a system that is has been for a long time too heavy, too formal, too attached to the old habits of politics within four walls. So the promises that Boric has made about structural changes, he also has a moderate program. He's not a communist. He's not a revolutionary. He's promising a social democratic way of changing things, which has raised, of course, many doubts. Many of the people who voted for Boric actually voted against this reinstallation of the Pinochet culture in government represented by this far-right candidate, Jose Antonio Kast.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate Alejandro Kirk there, a correspondent from Santiago. Well, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. The professor of Latin American and Caribbean Studies, Hostos Community College, Daniel Shaw, who joins us in New York. We also have author, journalist, and contributing editor for The Canada Files, Arnold August, who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Arnold August, let me first start with you. So what do we have over here? We have this this man, 35 years old, they keep talking about that in the media, who was the reception he had, the number of people who came out to vote for him was unbelievable. What is your initial reaction to how he has won this vote at this point?
Well, first thing, I think that the number of people that came out to vote for him was really outstanding, because the outgoing regime of Piñera did everything to try to hinder the people, especially in Santiago, which is very left-leaning, hinder them from voting by not supplying, as agreed upon, special transportation, special buses to allow people to go to the voting booth. So despite that, he got a very, very strong support and a most important vote for a president in the whole history of Chile. I think that I'm glad that your correspondent in Santiago raised the issue of the context. I just like to underline it, that this election, they took place in the context, especially of the fall 2019. I won't say protests. They were actually consisted of a rebellion, an uprising against a neoliberal order, and the bulk of the people involved in that were the youth. So it was very important that Boric wins that election against someone, Kast, who is a son of a Nazi and also open supporter of fascism. So some people, of course, as your correspondent hinted there, you know, not everyone was so enthusiastic about Boric, because he is not really a left winger. But just imagine today, if Kast would have won, what kind of a conversation we'll be having today, sure. And in Chile as well, as far as the outcome, how Chile is going further along the path after the elections from yesterday. So it was definitely a historic victory. And with regards to Boric, of course, it's very complicated. He has very good position domestically, for example, while Kast oppose abortion. Of course, Boric supports the right to abortion, as well as other increase in social welfare. Yes.
Great. Thank you. Well, let me ask you, if I may, here, Daniel Shaw, to the common person, if you can open this for us, as to what we're talking about when we're talking about a leftist, in which Boric has been described as, and then you talk about the far right, which was what his contender was, I guess, Kast, and then from where you have the previous president come. So as to set the stage for us, what different ideologies are in place here, especially regarding Boric, when he's been described as a leftist?
Good afternoon. We see once again the showdown of this battle of ideas. The son of a Nazi, as the other guest said, far right, Bolsonaro-esque, Trump wannabe, Duterte-esque, neoliberal, in the spirit of Sebastián Piñera, the billionaire president of Chile right now until March, when Boric comes into office. Boric, it remains to be seen if who won in Chile is a Bernie Sanders-esque figure, if he's slightly to the right of Bernie Sanders, slightly to the left. I mean, we know for certain this is not a Bolivarian anti-imperialist revolutionary. This is not Rafael Correa. This is not Nicolas Maduro. The first 100 days of Boric's cabinet will be very telling. Already Bloomberg is asking in the Financial Times out of London and all of the stock market analysts who will be selected as his finance minister, who will be his canciller or secretary of state. So they're already toying with the price of international price of copper. So big capital imperialism will flex its muscles if they don't like how Gabriel Boric signals. Not just in his first 100 days in 2022, but right now as we speak, he's supposed to be meeting with Sebastián Piñera in a similar way that in 2016 Barack Obama had to sit down with Donald Trump so that they can signal a smooth transition. But a transition for who? For imperialism? For capitalism? For neoliberalism? What type of transition are we talking about?
Sure. Big question there. Well, I'm glad you mentioned how the Wall Street and the financial world of respective institutions even maybe are looking at who he's going to pick for his finance minister. So let me ask you, Arnold August, I mean, didn't they do that with Piñera? I mean, wasn't he a businessman? He received a doctorate in economics from Harvard, and he came into his post 10 years ago. What did that do for the country? Did that actually do well? And more importantly, did the people receive economically the benefits of what his background had as to what we're looking at now with Boric?
Well, with the Piñera administration, and before that, Chile was known as the neoliberal model for all of Latin America. But what did it bring? It brought a revolt amongst the young people and also amongst the unions regarding that whole neoliberal outlook. So this, I think, truly turned a page against that past. But I'd like to raise a thing talking about the pressures that are being exercised by the international media and other countries against Boric. Now, Boric, internationally, he has sort of a mixed bag. On the issue of Israel, he's very good. He says Palestine is an apartheid state and he opposes Israel. But of course, I saw this morning the Israeli newspapers and American newspapers are already screaming, help, no, we can't read. The Chileans had no choice but to vote for a pro-Nazi and an Israel basher. So you already see the pressures coming in for him to change his position internationally. Now, he's taken a positive stand with regards to Bolivia. But on the other hand, one has to admit that with regards to Cuba, Venezuela, and Ecuador, he echoes the basic imperialist line against these countries and against these governments. So we have the pressure that will be coming internationally with regards to the makeup of his cabinet, how he's going to approach. Water is very important in Chile, and what do we do with that? And also, at the same time, the pressures internationally try to swing him away from supporting Palestine and supporting Bolivia. He is actually in a very difficult situation, and I hope that he withstands the pressures, not only with regards to Palestine and Bolivia, but also to revert the positions he had taken on Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba, because the best way forward for Chile, based on the experience coming out of the neoliberal experiment, was to forge links with these other countries, their neighbors in Latin America.
Sure.
Which, by the way, Latin America has very close ties with China. This, I think, is the way forward for Chile, and I just hope that this is the option that he takes in the coming weeks and months.
Well, let's look at the bigger picture here, Daniel Shaw. It was really spread throughout the media back in April 2021 when you had the elections happen in Peru with Pedro Castillo to have, claimed that. And then the news coming out, there's a leftist revival that's happening. It's spreading across Latin America, and it talked about Chile, Colombia, and Brazil. Of which we now have seen Chile to expect this shift to the left. What is going on? Is there a shift to the left? Is there a resurgence of that, I should say?
Yeah, no question this is the second wave, the second iteration of the pink tie. But notice it's a pink tie, it's not a red tie. A pink tie could still be amenable to imperialism. Imperialism is very astute. The U.S. Embassy and the intelligence services are working overtime in Chile, in Peru, in Honduras. How can they accommodate their interests to a more left-leaning Xiomara Castro, Pedro Castillo? They will attack diplomatically. They will attack. They could use every trick under their hat. The way it played out in Peru, within 19 days, the canciller, the Secretary of State, Hector Bejar, was forced to resign. They invented all of these excuses to get rid of this anti-imperialist Minister of Foreign Relations. So when Boric begins his cabinet picks in March of 2022, or slightly before, the Jerusalem Post just published a few hours ago, as Arnold August mentioned there, they're already accusing Boric of being an anti-Semite, but of course we're not confused that to stand with Palestine is not to be anti-Jewish or to be anti-Semite. It's to stand for the self-determination of the native people of what's called today the Middle East. So those first 100 days will be telling. We have to go back to 1973 when Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger promised that they would make the Chilean economy scream because Salvador Allende's government dared to be self-determining. So that's what's going to play out in 2022. We certainly hope that there's more of a Bolivarian integration, that these blockades, these genocidal blockades against the Nicaraguan people, against the Cuban people, against the Venezuelan people, that there's room to breathe and that the peoples of Latin America can continue to support one another.
Yeah, and I'm curious as to how this is going to play out, Arnold August, when it comes to OAS. Now, we know that OAS is heavily influenced by the U.S., and it actually has been faulted as such, yes. That it's basically that there's an imbalance there. U.S. initiatives are exercised through the member states, and, of course, the member states, they think that they're enjoying the U.S. support, whether it's financially or what have you. But do you think that the U.S. here is losing that kind of outlook amongst its members when they're seeing how, in general, the public is embracing these leftist politicians, and therefore it makes them think twice, should we go toe the line with the U.S., or, as you said, stick together with some of these other countries that have moved to the left?
Yes, I think that's a very good point. I agree with you. The OAS is definitely losing any credibility that it may have had. It's no secret that we know that the Secretary General of the OAS, which is, of course, situated in Washington, D.C., was really secretly or not hoping for a victory by a cast over the left-wing candidate. Now, I think it's quite ironic. Now, the overall mainstream media internationally, they're saying that the leftist Boric want a victory. Now, as Danny and I were saying, and yourself as well, you know, how much left he is, you don't really know. But the point is, in my view, it's ironic. By saying that the leftist candidate won, this is good, even if he's not that leftist, because it will encourage two important elections coming up in 2022. One is Brazil, and people in Brazil must say, oh, this is our chance. We want to join this tide of leftist presidents and vote for Lula. And even Colombia, the most important single ally of the United States in that region, elections are taking place there, and now there is a greater possibility that this inspiration coming from Chile, left-wing victory, would also play out in Colombia with the victory of Petro as a progressive candidate against the old line candidates and parties in Colombia. And if this takes place, these two elections take place favorably in 2022, it will be a major important geopolitical a change, not only for Latin America, but for all over the world.
Sure.
And so we should be hoping for good results in 2022.
Well, yeah, exactly. And those are a couple of the biggest countries there that you mentioned. But Danny Shaw, I'm sure, as you said, the CIA, the U.S. in particular, and perhaps some of the other Western countries allied to the U.S. are looking very closely at this. And, they can't just sit by idly and watch Latin America, these countries to join forces together and perhaps move as a wall against the U.S. and the world. Not that they're going to cut themselves off, but what types of reactionary moves do you think we'll see from the U.S.? And I'm guessing, and the West maybe, and I'm guessing it's going to be on the economic side, maybe through the IMF and the World Bank to try to push them on to try to see if they can control these countries. Am I correct to look at it that way?
Yeah, 100%. The hybrid wars are already have been unleashed against the Cuban people, the Venezuelan people, the Bolivian people. We saw the coup in Bolivia over 2 years ago. So they'll use any tactic. It could be through paramilitary outfits. Of course, the financial market trying to freeze Chile out. Again, as Arnold said, it's too early to forecast that. But if they want to try to bring Chile to their knees, they can cut them off from any type of credit. Bloomberg already announced that the price of copper internationally is down, and they signaled to the other copper producers in the world to produce more. Imperialism is very astute, and imperialism under Biden is arguably much more dangerous. The fox is much more dangerous than the wolf. I mean, Trump was too clumsy, too much of a loose cannon, but Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, they can dress themselves up in woke capitalist language. But it's clear that the Latin American peoples are saying we're no longer your backyard. It's not 1824. The Monroe Doctrine is obsolete. And as Arnold mentioned, I mean, the hopes right now of another PT Lula victory in Brazil, of a Petro victory in Colombia. But then there's the revolution, the momentum, the progressive momentum comes in stages, because so far Xiomara Castro is not questioning the U.S. military presence in Honduras. Pedro Castillo is barely surviving. The media monopolies are attacking him left and right. He hasn't even dared to utter a sentence yet. Sure. About the three illegal U.S. military bases in Peru. So we'll see how this class struggle plays out in the very summits of political power in Chile in the upcoming months.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That was Danny Shaw speaking there, professor of Latin American and Caribbean Studies at Hostos Community College. Thank you so much. And also, Arnold August, thank you, from Montreal, author, journalist, and contributing editor for the Canada Files. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Recovery Time, the entire team is goodbye until next time.
Limelight. Senator Joe Manchin, the West Virginia Democrat, effectively killed President Biden's signature domestic policy bill in its current form on Sunday, 19th of December, saying he was convinced the spending and tax cuts in the $2.2 trillion legislation will exacerbate already hot inflation. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jim Tankersley. The piece is titled, The Path Ahead for Biden, Overcome Manchin's Inflation Fears. Senator Joe Manchin, the West Virginia Democrat, effectively killed President Biden's signature domestic policy bill in its current form on Sunday, 19th of December, saying he was convinced the spending and tax cuts in the $2.2 trillion legislation would exacerbate already hot inflation. Economic evidence, though, strongly suggests that Joe Manchin is wrong. A host of economists and independent analyses have concluded that the bill is not economic stimulus and that it will not pump enough money into consumer pocketbooks next year to raise prices more than a modest amount. The reason has to do with the pace at which the bill spends money and how much it raises through tax increases that are intended to pay for that spending. The legislation spends funds over a decade, allowing the taxes it raises on wealthy Americans and businesses, which will siphon money out of the economy to help counteract the boost from spending and tax cuts. The bill also does not provide the type of direct stimulus included in the $1.9 trillion pandemic aid package that Joe Biden signed in March, and which Mr. Manchin supported. Some of its provisions would give money directly to people, like a continued expanded child tax credit, but others fund programs that would take time to ramp up, like universal pre-kindergarten. Economists say the net result is likely to be, at most, a tenth of a percentage point or two increase in the inflation rate. That would be a relatively small effect at a time when supply chain crunches, surging global oil demand, and a pandemic shift among consumers away from travel and dining out and towards durable goods have combined to raise the annual inflation rate to 6.8%, its fastest pace in nearly 40 years. For months, Senator Manchin has warned the president and congressional leaders that he was uncomfortable with the breadth of what had become a $2.2 trillion bill to fight climate change, continue monthly checks to parents, establish universal pre-kindergarten, and invest in a wide range of spending and tax cuts, targeting childcare, affordable housing, home health care, and more. He has cited both the risk of inflation and his fear that the package could further balloon the federal budget deficit, saying several programs that are now estimated to end in a few years would likely be made permanent. Over the past week, Senator Manchin has insisted that the bill should shrink to fit the framework of less than $2 trillion that Joe Biden announced this fall, and that, crucially, the legislation not use budget gimmicks to artificially lower the bill's effect on the budget deficit. Statement on Sunday, 19th of December, Senator Manchin said Democrats continue to camouflage the real cost of the intent behind this bill. White House officials have tried to promote the idea that the bill would reduce price pressures right away, an outcome that economists have not entirely bought into. But the general economic consensus finds little evidence to suggest the bill risks exacerbating rising food, rising gasoline, and other prices. Today's inflationary surge stems from a confluence of factors, many of them related to the pandemic. The coronavirus pandemic has caused factories to shutter and clogged ports, disrupting the supply of goods that Americans stuck at home have wanted to buy, like electronics goods, televisions, and home furnishings. That high demand has been fueled in part by consumers who are flush with cash after months of lockdown and repeated government payments, including stimulus checks. Research from the Federal Reserve has shown that inflation is most likely getting a temporary increase from the coronavirus relief package in March, which included $1,400 direct checks to families and generous unemployment benefits. But President Biden's social policy bill would do relatively little to spur increased consumer spending next year, and not enough to offset the loss of government stimulus to the economy as pandemic aid expires. White House aides have tried to make the case to Senator Manchin and the public in recent weeks, pointing to a series of analyses that have dismissed inflationary fears pegged to the bill. That includes analysis from a pair of Democratic economists who warned about rising inflation earlier this year, Harvard University's Lawrence Summers and Jason Furman, and from the nonpartisan Penn Wharton budget model at the University of Pennsylvania. All of those analyses conclude that the bill would add little or nothing to inflation in the coming year. The disconnect between economic reality and Senator Joe Manchin's stated concerns has exasperated the White House, which is struggling with voter discontent towards Joe Biden over rising prices, as well as an unyielding pandemic. In a scathing statement about Senator Manchin on Sunday, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki noted that the Penn Wharton analysis found that Joe Biden's bill will have virtually no impact on inflation in the short term, and in the long run, the policies it includes will ease inflationary pressures. White House officials, who along with party leaders have spent weeks trying to bring Senator Joe Manchin to a place of comfort with Joe Biden's bill,
registered a sense of betrayal after the senator's declaration. Jen Psaki said Senator Manchin had last week personally submitted to the president an outline for a bill that was the same size and scope as the president's framework and covered many of the same priorities. He had also promised to continue discussions towards an agreement, she said. Republicans celebrated Senator Manchin's statement as evidence that the bill, which Democrats were attempting to pass along party lines, was full of inflationary policies that even the president's own party could not get behind. Still, Senator Manchin's concerns leave the White House at least the possibility of a path forward, albeit not the one that President Biden set out to travel. Some Democrats and administration officials believe there is still a chance to recast the bill to suit Senator Manchin's demands and to possibly pass it in the early months of next year. The result would be a bill that would also be unlikely to fuel inflation next year, but which would be smaller. The number of programs it would contain would shrink, and it would include funding over the next 10 years to pay for the spending. Such changes would force the White House to once again make difficult choices about which party priorities to leave on the cutting room floor. President Biden began the year with a $4 trillion agenda to overhaul the government's role in the economy, fight climate change, and invest in America's children. He sliced off some of it for a bipartisan infrastructure bill he signed into law this fall, and has whittled down the rest of negotiations with moderates and progressives in his party, which controls the House and Senate by exceedingly narrow margins. As they scaled back the bill, Democratic leaders had essentially two choices. They could either focus on a few programs like tax credits for climate change and expanded benefit for parents that is meant to fight child poverty, and making pre-kindergarten free for 3 and 4 year olds across the country. Or they could pack as many programs as possible into the bill, setting some of them to expire after as little as a year to avoid ballooning the budget deficit and hope that lawmakers would extend them in the future. Leaders chose the pack-it-in strategy, in part because so many interest groups in their coalition, like environmentalists and labor unions, had competing priorities. Budget hawks urged a more targeted approach, fewer programs that were made permanent to avoid paying budget gains that could fuel the deficit down the road.